Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Strategy and Growth Roundtable for the Harvard Business School Association of Northern California. I'm Adrienne Ott, and I'm chair of the roundtable. And tonight's program, as you know, is Lessons on Business Growth and Risk with Dave Pitts, who is the founder of NetApp. We are so delighted and honored to have him here this evening. How many of you have started a company before? So quite a few of you. Okay, how many of you have taken that company past $1 million in revenue? Okay, excellent. How many of you have taken that company past $100 million in revenue? $1 billion? How about $3 billion? Well, tonight, we have a gentleman who has achieved that objective and taken a company from more than $3 billion, which is quite an accomplishment. I have to say that there are probably not too many people on the planet who have accomplished such an incredible feat, and this is why I'm so delighted and honored to have Dave Hibbs here tonight speaking with us. Dave, why don't you come on up, and I will go ahead and give a little bit of background on NetApp and your background. Just so we can get up to speed on the program. NetApp was founded in 1992, and he did this together with James Lau. The goal of that was a desire to simplify storage in the way that Cisco simplified networking. The company right now has, as I mentioned, about $3 billion in revenue, 130 offices worldwide. They're a Fortune 1000 company, ranked 642 as of the last Fortune ranking. And according to Hoover's, if my information is correct, you're still growing despite the downturn. You have some revenue growth going on.
So far.
Which is quite a feat in this environment, because I was preparing a presentation for Wednesday and looking at a lot of the companies in tech, and they're not doing so well. Flat is the new up. Actually, I was just looking at some industry analyst figures, and they were saying that this year, Gartner was saying there was going to be a percentage decline in IT spending. So there are pockets of growth, and NetApp happens to be in one of those. So congratulations on that. They have close to 7,600 employees, maybe beyond that. And they were named the best company to work for by Fortune magazine. So please join me in welcoming Dave Pitts.
Your comment about teaching someone to fish reminded me of a story that a friend of mine taught me. He said, not a story, a saying, he said, light a fire for a man and keep him warm for the rest of the night. Light a man on fire and keep him warm for the rest of his life.
Well, I have to ask you, I had the opportunity to read your book, and if those of you who haven't seen his book, it's just a delightful read, and just a wonderful, I love all the vignettes. But I have to ask you, and open the session with, how did you get to this title of How to Castrate a Bull?
That was an engineering code name. My background is engineering. All products must have a code name. I never expected to find a publishing house with the balls to leave that as the actual title. There's two stories of what the title means. How many people here have ever been in a job interview where you wrote out your resume, you handed it to the person? I mean, they're supposed to have read it, but it's very clear that the person interviewing you has not read your resume. They're doing things like, so I see you went to Harvard, and I see that your last job was at IBM. And so I was having a bunch of those at one period of my life, so I decided I'm going to put on the bottom of the resume, other experience, herding, branding, castrating, slaughtering cattle. So I'm in one of these interviews, and a woman does this thing. So I see you went to, and she gets to the bottom, and she does a double take, and she looks back up at me, and she says, management experience, I see. It's a metaphor for taking risk. I spent a couple of years working on a cattle ranch, and I noticed that a lot of the lessons of being on a cattle ranch were kind of like the lessons of being in a small startup later when I was working on a small startup. Not the part about actually shoveling the cow manure or putting up the barbed wire fence, but there you are in the middle of nowhere, and you have to do all these things, and you don't know how, and you roll up your sleeves and you do them anyway. How many of those people started a company? You all had that experience, right? And surely there it must be an expert in whatever this thing is that you're doing, and you're not it. But that person is nowhere nearby, and they're not going to come help you. But there are certain things that you encounter in this that they're more risky than the others, and maybe you should get lessons. And so one of the big tricks of risk is it appropriate risk to take? Is it inappropriate risk to take? And it turns out castrating a bull is in the category that you might want to get lessons first.
So with that, from the business side, what are some areas that you think where lessons are needed?
One of the things that I find interesting in the context of taking risk is how many people think about it all wrong. And let me just share a story from when we were first starting NetApp. My co-founder James and I, both of us, didn't have all that much money in the bank. We were trying to figure out if we should do this startup. In fact, it was the company we started before NetApp. This one eventually failed after about a year. But the interesting thing was, a lot of people that I knew at that time thought it made no sense to go do a startup. They were like, what are the odds? I mean, startups fail at a pretty high rate. What are the odds of this startup being successful? And they thought it wasn't something worthwhile doing. I noticed at that same time in my life that I had quite a few friends who were going back to business school. And when I did a comparison of my risk assessment and their risk assessment, what I concluded was my odds of successfully starting a company that would grow into something and work were very, very low. So my odds of success were small. But what was my downside? I would spend a couple years not getting paid, at the end of which I would have learned a whole lot. Now, I looked at my friends going to business school, and I did an assessment of their odds. They had exactly the same downside that I did. They would spend a couple of years not getting paid. In fact, they would pay money. At the end of which they would have learned a lot. But their upside odds of accidentally, as a result of this year or two spent, of accidentally starting a successful company were zero. And so I looked at that and said, how do you do a comparison of those two sets of risks and conclude that I was the one taking the higher risk? And in fact, the only way you could conclude that is if you just only look at the risk of the upside failing. And I think that, to me, that's one of the biggest business lessons, of the risk of the upside failing is actually not that bad of a thing. It's the risk of whatever the downside bad thing is that's the bad thing. And so you've always got to keep those both in mind.
So in light of that, Dave, just to bring this in a little bit closer, for a small company, what do you think are the biggest risks?
In this economy right now, dying. Seriously, when running out of cash, I think for both big and small companies, the biggest risk is not changing. When the economy turns down, what I've noticed is a lot of people use that as an opportunity to kind of hunker down and whatever we've been doing, let's maybe do a little bit less of it. And I do believe that in a downturn like this, a lot of the reasons that your customers were buying, whatever those reasons were before, probably they're different. Our VP of worldwide sales for a long time, now he's our vice chairman, but he had a saying, people only open their wallet when they're in pain. I mean, you've got to find something that the customer, not only is it a problem, but it's a problem that concerns them enough that they actually will choose to spend money to try and fix it. So what's my point? I believe that when an economy goes down, a lot of the things that people used to feel were painful enough that they would spend money to fix, they won't anymore. The good news, though, is in a downturn like this, there's so much new pain. And so you asked me, and people only open their wallet when there's pain, right? Actually, if people get so pessimistic, I do think it's funny. When you look at the overall economic numbers and the percentage of money that customers are spending and, you know, how bad is the economy, really, I remember, and this turned out not to be right, but people were talking doom and gloom is going to be horrible. And I was listening on the radio, and they were talking about the Christmas spending. This was long about November coming in. And on the radio, they said, oh, my God, it's so awful that Christmas spending might only be 2% higher than it was last year instead of 4% higher. And, I mean, it turned out it actually did go down a bit. But I was surprised by it. One, I was surprised by two things. I was thinking, who on earth is spending more money on Christmas this year than last? Did anybody here think they did? I was baffled by how it could go up 2% even in the face. But the reality turned to be it was like down 1% or 2%. I mean, it was astounding. And a lot of the, when you look, I mean, profits go up and down a lot because they're sort of on the margin. But when you look at the actual total spending, it hasn't changed that much. I mean, there's very few companies. There's a few. The airlines are doomed in the, you know, for the time being, and the hotels. But for the most part, when you look at companies, they're spending 80% as much, and a lot of them 90% as much as they were before of their total budgets. So there's still enormous opportunity out there, but they are, the shock to the system has radically changed the buying pattern. So a lot of people don't change enough, I think, in times like this.
Do you think that's all? That's also a problem with big companies, too, as you mentioned?
You know, I suspect it might be worse for big companies because they can often ride these. I mean, look at General Motors. When's the last time they changed? No, I mean, I think big companies a lot of times can. For little companies, the downside's going under. You know, what's the biggest risk? Little companies, the downside's going under. Big companies, the downside is being mortally wounded in a way that won't really show up for 5 years, and then 20 years later you die. It's astounding how long it takes big companies to die. I mean, even medium big companies, a couple hundred million. We were competing. You know, there's this weird, you guys all went to business school, so you know this, but I didn't go to business school, so I had to learn some of these things. But there's this odd thing, when a company is growing really fast, even though it's profitable, it can be sucking up cash. You all know this, right? And so you always have to be doing IPOs and secondary offerings to raise all the money. You're buying long-term assets. And so even though you're wildly profitable, you're sucking up cash. You're very cash flow negative. It turns out the math reverses when companies are shrinking. And so you can have these wildly unprofitable companies that keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and spitting out cash. It's the most bizarre thing. They'd last for, the one we were competing with probably took them about 15 years to die. Blew me away.
So with that, Dave, you obviously...
Have I answered any of your questions yet?
Yes, you have. Actually, you've done very well. I wanted to ask you, I mean, obviously you were an entrepreneur during a good portion of watching your company grow. Given today's environment, what are a couple things that you would advise entrepreneurs today?
What was the question?
Are you going to answer? If you had to do it over again.
I have, no. I have an answer. I was just stalling for time. I do have an answer. I think, so you do have to take the economic situation into account, right? And I do think a lot of people are changing their behavior as a result of that. And I have three words of advice that I think should be the guiding principle for somebody trying to get into business. And the three words are good enough considering. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think a lot of customers out there, whatever it is that they were thinking they would do, their plans are different, and they're going to choose something that's good enough considering instead of whatever they were going to choose. So for instance, in your personal lives, and I know everybody will be in a different place in their personal life, but you might be considering a car, your old car's broken down, and so we finally it's gotten to the point where you just can't put off purchasing a new car anymore, and man, that BMW 5 Series was looking pretty nice. But you know what? A Chevrolet might be good enough considering. I actually think there's enormous opportunity right now for people trying to get customers to do something a different way. And this is a lesson that I actually learned in the last downturn. And it's a lesson that NetApp, just to give you a little bit of perspective, during most of the 90s, NetApp was growing 2x per year. So during the early part of the 90s, we were growing faster. We did 7x and then 3x, and then it dropped down to about 2x, and it stayed there up until we hit a billion in 2001, our fiscal 2001. And towards the end of that period, we realized that we were dangerously concentrated in high tech and internet, like 100%. And so our CEO, Dan, was paranoid, and the VP of sales and the CFO, and they concluded we should try and crack some new industries. And so we went out and we did telcos, banking and finance, major manufacturing, oil and gas, and federal government. Those were the ones we set target at. So starting sort of late 90s, our vice president of sales, Tom Mendoza, was going to a lot of the folks on Wall Street, and he managed to get appointments and trying to sell to them. And the problem that he faced was interesting. I remember he came back and he described one sales call in particular. He said he went in to meet with the CIO. He finally managed to get an appointment with the CIO. It was a woman. And she started the conversation. She said, "I think I know your sales story. The basic idea is you can do everything my current vendor can do, but you can do it for half the price, right?" And Tom's like, this is going to be great. She completely understands us. And she goes on to say, with a pitch like that, you won't sell anything on Wall Street. And it took me a long time to figure out why she wasn't an idiot. And the reason that she wasn't an idiot, and she kind of tried to explain it to Tom, but it just couldn't even sink into our heads. The reason she wasn't an idiot, because Wall Street at that time also was growing fairly quickly from all the high-tech IPOs. And her number one requirement from her boss was, don't let the IT infrastructure slow down this company's growth. Whatever you do, don't do anything that would cause the IT infrastructure to slow down this company's growth. And that was goal number two and goal number three also, by the way. And so, from her perspective, cutting half the money out of one portion of her budget but imposing some risk was a horrible trade-off. I mean, her explanation at the time, she said, my current stuff works pretty well and I have plenty of money. That, which, again, that didn't sound like a good reason, but in fact, as I think about it after the fact, a lot of times in a high-growth situation, letting some inefficiencies build up in order to avoid. I mean, would you rather take 0.5% out of your overall business stack or avoid imposing any additional risk on a 30% per year annual growth rate? All right, well, you put it that way, that. But after the crash, and so we made very little progress on Wall Street during the late 90s. After the crash, going back and visiting those same folks with exactly the same story, same products, you know, a few years later, completely different story. We made enormous amounts of progress in Wall Street, and it was all about they were now in a position where if they didn't save a bunch of money, they were doomed, and if they had to take some risk to do it, that was the price they would pay. Good enough considering.
That's a great story. You talk in your book about hypergrowth and what happens in hypergrowth, and I was quite struck by the comment you said, during hypergrowth, everything is always broken. And I was wondering if you could share with us, so how do you cope and manage in that kind of environment?
Well, first of all, let me talk about why everything's always broken. One of the things that we learned in hypergrowth, let me just put these numbers in perspective. The very first year we sold anything was 93, and we sold $2 million worth of stuff. 94, 14 million, 95, 45, 90, 180, 3-something, 6-something, a billion. That was the path that we were on. And our business model, from about the time we hit 50 million, our business model was pretty mature in terms of percentage of budget in different parts and the revenue per head. And so during most of that period, the headcount was also doubling. So the revenue was doubling, the headcount was doubling, the install base was doubling, number of customers. And here's what we learned. Almost never was it possible to install any kind of business process, business system, IT solution that was likely to last for 3 years. And the reason for that was most IT solutions are not designed to scale by a factor of 10. And the difference between a $10 million company's processes, structure, business, and $100 million, it's really different. And from $100 million to a billion, so few companies grow that quickly that there's just not really a market for products that will scale. And so you have to keep throwing the old one away. And you just kind of get used to stuff being broke. So there were a bunch of lessons from that. I mean, one of the key lessons, because you asked, how do you deal with that culturally? What do? To me, one of the most important things was to get people used to it. We would do new hire training. And I would just tell people, look, everything all around is broken. Here's the reason. It's a sign of success. And you might as well get used to it, right? And one of the things that I advised people was I said, you should be a little bit careful about how much you criticize whatever idiot put that solution in place, because there aren't many solutions that will scale by a factor of 10. And if you're friendly to your ancestors, you should keep in mind in 3 years, whatever solution you put in will be busted and you'll be the idiot. And so if you help foster a culture of kindness to the idiot that put the system in, you might be the beneficial recipient a couple years ahead. So that was one of the cultural things.
You also had alluded a little bit to a stitch in time. How do you prioritize? When everything is broken, how do you prioritize what to fix, or do you fix it at all?
You know, the stitch in time metaphor, a stitch in time saves nine, would seem to imply that if you see something broken, you should fix it, right? That's the whole point of that metaphor. So I did a little math in my head, and I said, When is that just false? When is this? Because we did, in fact, have so much broken stuff that we couldn't fix them all. And here was what I observed. Suppose you have 20 stitches, and let's just say the math is true. It really is the case that a stitch in time will save 9. But suppose you have 20 stitches, and only one of them is going to come undone, and you don't know which one. Now the math says you can fix them all, and do that took you 20 stitches. You can wait, see which one broke, and that only took you 9. Sometimes it's actually better off just to let stuff break, figure out what broke, and then fix it, as long as it's a low enough percentage of things that are going to be so bad broken that you actually need to fix them. It's astounding how much stuff you can leave broken for a long, long time, and it won't kill you. Right, and then there's that fraction that if you don't fix them, they will kill you. So that's the trick, is figuring out which ones. But you just, in that kind of a hypergrowth, you just can't fix everything.
So as part of that, are you looking at the stitches, using the metaphor, and actually assessing the risk of those stitches? Or are you just saying, I'm going to wait and see what breaks?
Certainly things... Usually in business, things don't, like, the day before yesterday they were broken, and the day after, or were not broken, and then the day after they're broken. Usually there's kind of a continuum. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what we did was we kind of listened to how loud the screams were, you know, of the people complaining about stuff. Some people have argued that doubling every year imposes so much pain on a company that it's not worth it. And one of my favorite stories about this came from Jeffrey Moore in his book Crossing the Chasm. And the story that he told was about two computer industry companies. One of them was growing at 2x annual growth rate, and the other one, the CEO said, I don't believe we can continue to serve our customers well. I don't believe that we can maintain product quality, maintain customer service quality, maintain the quality of the people we hire if we grow faster than 50% per year. And so that CEO capped the growth. So you look at how this played forward, and I'll tell you the names of the two companies, and maybe you can figure out how the strategies worked out. One of them was Oracle, and one of them was Ingress. Anybody here heard of Ingress? Ingress is the one that made the decision to cap growth at 50%. And the interesting thing is, for a little while, it might actually have worked, which is they might have been better in some way. But if you do the math on that, the exponential math, it doesn't take very many more years before the one is enormous and the other is teeny. And how well can you serve a broad range of customers if you're teeny compared to the giant guy? And so we actually had, during the hypergrowth period, we had a saying which was, double or die. Because we really believed we had a big technological advantage that would last for some period of time against much larger competitors. IBM and HP were ones, although we actually worried a lot more about one named EMC. But we figured we had, as a result of the technological advantage, which we hoped would last for a while, but we had a period to strike. And if we didn't do the most we could do during that period, which I believed was doubling, I went and did some library research back before the internet, on growth rates of companies that seemed to me to be like ours. So companies that had to hire people to go install systems and build systems and interact with customers. And the result that I found was you can get to 100 million basically instantly. From 100 million to a billion at that time, it looked like the best you could do was double. And then after a billion, it seemed like it slowed down to about 50%. So since then, there have been a couple of companies that grew, maintained the doubling growth of it past a billion. But in general, I think that doubling, for if you're growing your employee base, seems to be the best you could do. So we just set that as an A-plus target and tried to hit it.
Great. That's a great example. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about culture, because I know that's something that is very important.
Near and dear to my heart.
I thought it was interesting. I was reading lately about the whole data domain acquisition and the questions with EMC, and certainly that...
We bid $25 on data domain. EMC bid $30. We matched them. And now if I say any more, I think it's me that goes to jail, but maybe some of you too. I forget.
Well, I'm not so interested in the financial specifics of that, but there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about the culture and how many of the data domain employees were in favor of moving with NetApp as opposed to EMC because of West Coast versus East Coast and cultural differences. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think part of it's East Coast, West Coast. Let me talk a little bit about culture. Our CEO, Dan, he's been with the company now for, he joined in 94. And Culture was very important to him. He really wanted to make NetApp be a place that employees would want to work and a place that customers would want to do business with. He joined when we were 40 people. We had raised some VC money, but we weren't profitable. We didn't have enough customers. Our channel to market, that in retrospect, it was impossible for us to sell enough to succeed with the indirect channel that we were using. So we had some pretty serious problems. And Dan, the new CEO, decided that, among other goals, one of his top goals was going to be that we should have a list of company values. And I remember the meeting where he announced this to the company shortly after he joined as the new CEO, and we all thought he was a complete idiot. I mean, it was like a Dilbert moment, you know? But, oh, yeah, value. Good. We don't have money. We don't have customers. How about values? Let's make a list of values. One woman actually stood up and she said, I would like to know, how are these values going to be used against us? And so Dan actually put this on the back burner for quite a while. I'm not answering your question yet, am I? No.
You are.
Eventually, I'll get there. So Dan put these on the back burners. This company values thing did not work at all. Part of the reason I was skeptical, a couple reasons, I didn't understand, how could a company even have values? Aren't values a thing people have? Like, what does it mean for a company to have values? That was one confusion I had. It felt dangerously close to some other areas, like, I'm Democratic. Is my boss going to tell me I have to vote Republican? Like, what kind of values is he talking about? Or, I'm an atheist, he was Catholic. The whole thing felt uncomfortable. When I got to know him better, I started understanding a lot better what he was talking about in the context of values. And in particular, his company prior to NetApp, he had a very interesting experience. He was hired at the company, it was NET. He worked at HP, left HP to join NET, Network Equipment Technology, as they built remember before the phone company would do all the phone stuff, Centrex stuff that people would build PBXs, they built those. So he joined as COO, and he had one of his big customers, a number of them actually weren't paying their bills very well. And so he went, he gathered up the purchase orders, he went out to have a negotiation with the CFO at this company to see if he could figure out what was going on. And they're going through purchase orders, here's one you paid, here's one you paid, here's one you haven't paid, why won't you pay this? The CFO looks at the purchase order and looks down at the bottom and says, you know, that's not my signature. It turned out that at NET, the sales force was shipping equipment to people that they hadn't ordered, shipping equipment into warehouses that, like, were disappearing. And so this is what Dan was just starting to uncover when the CFO said, that's not my signature. By the time they were finished, the VP of Worldwide Sales was fired, the Chief Financial Officer was fired, the CEO was fired, and Dan became the new CEO. The stock dropped from 36 to 5. And because so many of the profits had been fake, they actually had to do, and they'd been hiring on the basis of these fake profits, they had to lay off about a third of the workforce. So when Dan said, I would like to make a list of company values, what he was really saying is, I don't ever want to go through that experience again. And so he started to get to know him and some of the things. So 14 years later, I still don't think Dan and I have ever voted for the same presidential candidate. And that's fine. That's completely fine. But so what are values? He could have made a much longer list of things like no sending equipment, you know, no forging customer signatures, right? No sending equipment to secret warehouses. But you come up with, like you say, integrity. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about values, one of the feelings I had when we finally got around, okay, let's create some values, I'm getting this, I felt like ours should be unique. And, you know, that one's been taken, the integrity one. And it made me think about, like, the values in that context are sort of the rules for running a company, right? We're not talking about your religion or your politics. We're talking about the rules in the context of the company. And it reminded me a lot of the Constitution for a country, right? This is the set of stuff, the way that we're going to run the country. And I was imagining a band of people starting their new country, and they're writing the Constitution, and one of the guys says, how about freedom of speech? And the other one says, oh, no, no, that one's been taken. It was like, you don't think that way. Of course, you go steal the good ideas from other people's constitutions. So we ended up with a pretty standard list of them, you know, don't lie to people, work hard, that kind of stuff. There were a couple of them that I thought were interesting. We focused a lot on simplicity, trying to keep things simpler. During hypergrowth, we often tried to minimize the size of the rule book, you know, just sort of let things break. If people break the rules, we'll go talk to them. If we need a rule, eventually we'll make it. But I mean, don't make...
Is that when you had the values as well, working with them?
We did have the values, but so it took down about a year, year and a half. So okay. It was all through the hypergrowth.
But that helped to guide some of the simplicity.
I think so, yeah. But one that we had, which I think is interesting, we didn't want to have prima donnas. We wanted to have a model of teamwork and a more egalitarian model. And I have to say, I think that one's a choice. You know, look, you look at some Hollywood companies or some design firms, and their conclusion is the essence of our business is to find a handful of really, really smart people, really talented people, build up a support structure around them, and those people just like shit on the little people around them, right? But that's the culture we're building. And we concluded, I mean, you could build a software company on that model, but we concluded that's not the kind. We want a culture of more cooperation and teamwork. And the more I got to understand the zone of what Dan was talking about, the more it felt to me like a perfectly reasonable thing for companies to have values like that.
Great. What would you have done differently if you had to do it over again? You've seen a lot.
I always struggle to answer that question. And here's the reason. I have a big belief that a lot of times the thing you do starting out is a good thing for its time. Just like the business system that you put in, right? You put in this business system and it was good enough for 3 years, and then you have to rip it out and put in another one. But that doesn't mean it was a bad idea to rip it out and put in another one. So a lot of the decisions that I look at, and they turned out problematic, but we survived them. And I think, well, man, you know, maybe if we'd have spent a whole lot more on that something, it would have lasted another year. But that would have been money from when we were really little and didn't have that much money. And maybe we would have gone under, you know. And so I'm very hesitant to second guess the kind of success that we've had.
Well, that kind of follows with your comments about hypergrowth and how at different stages of your growth, you're going to need different things, and you may need to throw away mm-hmm. some of the things that you had. So those aren't necessarily bad decisions at that point in the game.
No, not at all. So, you know, I do feel like we've been either a very skillful or a very lucky company or some fraction of both. And most of the decisions I look at, it's really hard to tell. But one of the big, big decisions that we faced, for a long time, we were focused on one particular technology called NAS, which, like, it doesn't even matter what that is. It stands for Network Attached Storage. And we were having this big religious debate about whether we should get into a different type of technology called SAN, which stands for Storage Area Network. So 2 out of 3 of the words are the same. But it was this big religious debate about whether we should get into this new business or not. And in the end, we decided to. And we've done very well. That's been a high-growth part of our business. That was in, I think, 2001, 2002 that we made that decision. Even now, many years later, looking at it, we still have discussions about was that actually the right thing to do or not. I mean, the path that we took doing it worked out well, but what would the path that we would have gone on if we didn't do that have looked like? And I don't know how to answer that question. Most of the ones that mattered aren't that easy to tell.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So with that, I thought what we could do is open the floor if any of you have questions. I'm going to go ahead and repeat the question because we're podcasting this and we want to make sure that we're capturing the questions. So does anybody have any questions for Dave? Alexander.
Can you give us a little insight on the genesis, how you saw the opportunity and what were the events that kind of led up to you seeing the opportunity and founding the company?
So the question was, how did you see the genesis of the opportunity? How did you find it, and what led up to it?
I had been doing computer science stuff. I was a programmer by training. I went to Princeton because Harvard turned me down. And so my background was programming, and I ended up doing a lot of work related to storage over the years. I mean, in college, my advisor got me doing some work related to storage over the network. I went to MIPS Computer and did work related to storage over the network, which is what NetApp does, is storage over the network. Just to give you a sense, we sell enormous boxes of disk drives to customers, big companies that store large amounts of data there. So some examples, all of Yahoo's emails on our storage, a lot of special effects companies, all of the special effects for Lord of the Rings, and not the early Star Wars, which was like done with cameras on stuff, but the later, the computer Star Wars. If you've paid your taxes electronically, the IRS uses our equipment to store that stuff. So anyway, let's just give you a sense. I worked at a company called Auspex that also did storage over the network. So it was the thing I've been doing for quite a while. And then James and I, my co-founder, decided to leave and go to a pen-based computer company. This was back in the early 90s. So all the things that turned into Palm Pilots, this was the generation before that flopped. So that was what our wisdom led us to do. And after doing that for a year and realizing this is flopping, a guy that James and I had worked with at Auspex called us up and said, I have this idea. And so James and I are the two founders that remain at NetApp. But the other founder, Mike Malcolm, is the one who called us up. And it was an idea back in the disk storage market. And the key thing he observed was that these Intel PCs, the cheap little one-board computers, x86, that were cheap, commodity because they were being used for desktop, that if you wrote a custom operating system, he believed it was designed just to do one thing, that was the whole simplicity like Cisco, that what we would be able to do was sell a high-end server, not like high-end, but you know, a server class system built on this super cheap stuff. And that ended up being the sort of foundational ideas of, hey, how are we going to make this thing simple, better write the code smaller so it'll fit on these stupid little systems, and the thing was cheap, and by making it do just one thing so simple, so that really was our foot in the door. And over the years, we've added a lot of other stuff, and you know the market's changed, but that was really the founding thing. One of my favorite books is The Innovator's Dilemma, and it to Clayton Christensen, Harvard, isn't he? Yeah. So before I came here, my boss said, "Hey Dave, I've got this joke for you. How do you tell if somebody went to Harvard?" Okay. They'll tell you. So his idea is things that start very low end and sort of work their way up, you know, transistor radios against tubes. They start as this really sucky, cheap thing for teenagers and work their way up over the years. His argument was that is an incredibly successful business approach. If you can find such things, Honda dirt bikes against Harley Davidson's. I mean, a completely different sector of the business. Eventually worked them the way up. PCs against Unix. I mean, all of... And so we had this cheap little storage system that attached over the Ethernet, you know, which at the time they had much bigger, more powerful networks for mainframes and stuff. And we attached this Ethernet. We introduced in 92, 93. And long about 95, 96, the Internet was catching on all over Ethernet, and everybody in the world was going, hey, maybe I should put my storage over this stuff too, that zone of company. And we were like, oh, that turns out to be what we specialize in, right? I mean, so it was a niche-y little market that we expected initially. I mean, you ask how many people have taken their company to a billion or whatever. We never imagined when we created this thing that there was an opportunity for more than, you know, single digits of hundreds of millions. You know, maybe we could do 100, maybe we could do 500, but I mean, multiple billions, we just didn't see the market that way.
So. Did you anticipate that you would stay with that or think possibly you might get acquired at some point when you were thinking at that stage?
We had this idea of build a box to do just one thing. We called it an appliance. And we figured, we were ambitious. We figured we'll do this storage appliance thing, and then maybe we'll do some other appliances. And so instead of naming our company something about storage, we named it Network Appliance, later shortened to NetApp, with this theory that once we chewed up storage, we'd move on to the next thing. And I mean, here we are 17 years later, $3.5 billion, and we're still in the storage market. Because the little low-end niche we served merged with this enormous high-end market. Again, so much for our foresight and planning.
Peter.
What have you changed at NetApp in the last 18 months?
I need to repeat, but I didn't quite.
What have you changed at NetApp in the last 18 months?
The question was, what have you changed at NetApp in the last 18 months?
We're looking at changing a bunch of stuff. Some of it we've already changed. Some of it's in process. I have this theory of looking at company strategy in the context of eras. And let me define what I think an era is. This is true for companies. It's true for history. I mean, I first thought of it in the context of history. But an era is a particular, a period of time where if you make the list of the top three or five strategic issues for your company, and then you look at the previous period, the definition, my definition of an era is it's when most of those top three or top five are different. Right, and so you go, I mean, when you look historically, you see these eras of we're in the Cold War, and then like Russia's gone, we're not in the Cold War. Just all of the top things are different. And the reason I found that to be interesting from a strategy perspective is, I mean, everybody makes their list of top items this year, right? But when you kind of go a little bit further back and say, what's the big picture going on? When you do hit a period when the issues are fundamentally different, at that point in time, I think it's appropriate to rethink your strategy pretty seriously. And let me give you a couple of examples just to flesh this out, and then I'll actually go into what you're thinking. When we were very, very small, so startup, pre-IPO, the key issues we were faced with were, what exactly are we going to make? How are we going to build it? Who are we going to sell it to? How will we sell it to them? Direct channels, and all these very definitional issues. Later, as we got into our hyper-growth, doubling thing, the fundamental issues we faced largely were issues around how do we not run the wheels off as we're doubling every year. Almost all of the issues were around growth, maintaining culture, fixing broken business systems. I mean, it was just, you look at the list from here and the list from here, and they were fundamentally different. Now, in that case, I'm eventually getting to your answer. In that case, the transition from the definitional era of the startup to the hyper-growth era was kind of, I mean, when there were three of us to start, and we hired three more people, and there were six, so I guess it was hyper-growth, right? But it was still, we sat around the table, and we could chat. It wasn't until we started hitting 25 and then double to 50, and then 50 and double to 100, 100 to 200, we started realizing, wow, this, when you're 50, you can't memorize everybody's name anymore, and you double again, and we started realizing there was a different zone of problems. Sometimes eras run smoothly into each other like that. Other times, eras come at you more suddenly. So when the end of the hypergrowth era for us was when the tech crash hit. There was no sort of, gee, I wonder if we're still in the definitional or whether we've gone to hyper. It was like, bang. And I think this economy has had that same effect, right? Just a lot of stuff is different. And so it's really causing us to look at a lot of things. And a number of them are things that we kind of knew were there before. Like the reason I gave the example of the startup era going to the hypergrowth era, we really were growing fast, and it was kind of an issue of how do you double that quickly, but it wasn't the key thing. So some of the things that we've seen now, if you look at our business stack, our SG&A is kind of fat. Statistically, our SG&A is higher than it should be, and at high growth rates, that's been something that we could kind of get away with. But at this growth rate, it's like, you know, that's just not acceptable. So we knew that we needed to fix it. We had some programs, but we've gotten much more on that. That is something that we needed to work on. The other thing, if you look at the computer industry as a whole, there's a couple of big trends. One of them is VMware, server virtualization. Microsoft has got their Hyper-V. The amount of money you save with that stuff is incredible. But it's risky. And so our belief is that the exact same dynamic is going to go on with that I described with the Wall Street banks, right? That a lot of people who are a little bit of slow getting into it in this economy, and in fact, part of what we've seen is of all the IT projects getting canceled, ones involving VMware are typically the ones that keep running. So we've really ramped up our focus on that. Just because, so who's going to be the storage behind it? To what extent can we do that? I mean, so there's been a few eras like that. But I do believe that coming into this new period, efficiency, stuff, a lot of the stuff is because we grew so fast that we don't have as clean business processes and stuff that we shouldn't. We've kind of gotten away with it, but it's so we've sped up the some of the business process reengineering kind of stuff.
I'm going to take somebody from the back. Okay. He's jumping up and down at his seat. It's actually in the way back.
I was wondering, what's the strategy behind you never acquire a disk drive company? I mean, I'm always puzzled by why NetApp never bought like any company that makes disk drives since you're in the storage business.
Okay, so the question was, why has NetApp not bought a disk drive company?
I don't know the strategy. Why they always resist to
Yeah, what's the strategy behind that?
We never viewed that as tempting. So why never buy a disk drive company? We make equipment full of all sorts of other people's stuff. Right? I mean, it's got CPU chips in it, but it never occurred to us to buy Intel. It's got disk drives in it, but it never occurred to us to buy disk drives. The disk drive industry is a very dog food commodity market with low margins. Clayton Christensen, he talks a lot about the disk drive industry. He actually did a lot of his research on that. He said, disk drive companies pop up and then die. They are the fruit flies of the business world. And when we look at what it is that we mostly do, it's true that we sell big, giant boxes full of disk drives. But this is the trick of it. We don't make the disk drives, and mostly we don't make the boxes. What we actually do is we develop lots of software to help people with all the problems they have on account of all the disk drives we sold them. And we're largely a software company. If you disassemble, most of our engineers are software engineers. Most of the value we add, and if you look at our company's overall gross margins, they're about 60%, which is interesting. If you look at Cisco's overall gross margins, they're about 80%. Cisco is even more so a software company than we are. The tin wrap software, right? They put them in these big boxes they call routers, and they fill them up with software, sell it that way. Our gross margins are 60 because we have two components. We have the storage controller, which has gross margins about like Cisco's, and then we have all these disk drives, which we buy and sell through, which have gross margins a lot lower. Right? But I mean, we buy them. I don't know. It was never tempting at all. It didn't seem to have any affinity with either the business model or there were multiple companies. The other thing about disk drive vendors is every year, one disk drive vendor gets to the next biggest size disk first and makes a killing and all of the rest lose money. And then the next year, it's a different one gets to the next biggest size first and all the other rest get, it was, I don't know.
It is definitely your turn. Thank you for being patient.
Answer this by tempering your first business startup failure to your second obvious success. What are the three critical success factors of starting a business up to maybe 100 million?
Okay. So to repeat the question, what are the top three critical success factors you found to get a business to 100 million?
So, and you were asking by contrast with the first one. So James and I went off to do this startup. There was this new generation of computers, pen-based computers. You might remember the Apple Newton. That was one of the ones of that generation. There was a company called Momenta, another company called Go, EO, all of these ones, early 90s. So I would say rule number one is start your startup in an industry which is going to be successful. Because none of those, we were writing software for a set of platforms, none of which succeeded. So we were doomed. Now, I'm not sure it was a bad bet. The bet that we were taking at the time, our view of the computer industry was, once upon a time there were mainframes, and all these people figured out mainframes, and they wrote software for those and sold it. And then there was the mini computers, the DEX. And people jumped on and made software and sold them. And then later there was the Unix computers and then the PCs. The PCs had been the most recent one. And we looked like the people who invented the spreadsheet on the PC. And you know the stories. It was like Jobs and Wozniak in their garage inventing the computer. And then all these other companies doing software for these things. Like the ones that started early got the jump on the market. And our theory, which I still think was actually a pretty good theory, our theory was if we could get out there and get a jump on this market and be the guys in the garage writing software for these new platforms, that if that new platform took off, which in fact it did eventually, right? I think that's the predecessor to what's the smartphone now. So what was wrong with it? A couple things were wrong with it. It was way too big, so it weighed several pounds. It wouldn't fit in your pocket like today's smartphones. The battery life was about 2 hours, which is problematic for a device you carry all day with you. And they never got the handwriting recognition to work. No one had invented the micro keyboard yet, right? So there were just a bunch of reasons that those things ended up dying. But as a strategy, being early on, I look back at that, and I can't fault that strategy. If those guys had gone, we would have been in the right place at the right time, and I think we would have done pretty well. But there was another flaw with our plan, which is neither James or I knew anything about that style of market. So, I mean, I've been doing, remember I described my career earlier, storage somewhere over a network in college at my first company, at my second company, right? And so then went to do this startup. The project that we actually had targeted for ourselves was writing planning tools for busy executives. Very natural thing to have on a Palm-based computer, and in fact turned out to be one of the very successful applications. Neither James nor I had ever been a busy executive. We knew some. We went and asked them some questions. But there's a saying in the software world that if you had to choose between two products, say it's a product for chefs, and one of the products for chefs is a software product written by a chef who knows nothing about computer programming, and man, did that guy struggle with the programming of it. And the other is a really slick programmer putting together this software product for chefs who's never cooked. You always should go with the one written by the guy doing the thing. It may be busted in a whole bunch of ways, but the chef is going to figure out something that will actually be useful to a chef. Right? And so that was a very fundamental mistake, I think, that James and I made. And then when we went back, Mike Malcolm called us up and said, hey, I've got this idea about accessing storage over the network. And two things. One, we were much, much more productive. We weren't like the sharpest tools in the toolbox in this other area. So we were at a disadvantage already. But two, because it was our home turf and we'd been selling in that place, worked with customers, solved their problems, I think we had much better instinct about whether this is going to be successful or not. So I think being in a business closer to home, remember once, when was it, the 60s, the 70s, some business school came up with this theory, like you didn't need to know anything about an industry to manage in it. You just like, you could do enough spreadsheets. Maybe that's true for some big company, I don't know, but for startups, I don't believe so at all. I think because you can't afford to hire product marketing people and all that. You either have your own intuitive understanding of what those people need or you don't. And so I think that was a problem. I can't think of a third rule. But anyway, choose enough. Worth what you pay.
I'm going to take someone over here.
First, I want to make a comment. Thank you so much for focusing on corporate values. That's refreshing to hear and not heard often enough these days.
Oh, in this business climate, too, you look at some of the stuff going wrong?
My question has to do with the Fortune article, which I read. Nagi was an amazing achievement for NetApp. Look at the 9 below you in the top 10. That you accomplished more than they. That itself is a real exciting thing. My question is, I can understand how you could build morale with 40 people, but in the article, your customers and your staff and employees love your company. What is it that the 7,500 people are finding with NetApp that the other companies aren't?
The question is, you can understand creating enthusiasm among employees if you have about 40 employees, but you have 7,600 employees. How do you do that?
So first of all, you commented about the Fortune and the companies we displaced. It was absolutely the luckiest stroke for us ever that Google is the company that had number one position in this particular award, Great Place to Work Award, 2 years in a row. And the reason for that is because, one, it's Google, so everybody's heard of them. And as a result of them winning this award, everybody had heard of this award. So the headline was, company you've never heard of displaces Google from famous award. If it had been any other company, the headline would have been, company you've never heard of displaces other company you've never heard of for award you've never heard of. And for those of you who know anything about headline placement, that turns out not to be an interesting headline. So we got a lot of PR just through the luck of that. How do we do this for 76, however many people it is, 100 people? I believe that a big part of our success in this area has been Dan's focus. Remember, I mean, right when he showed up, Dan said, what should our values be? That, right from the very beginning, that was something very much on his mind in all sorts of different ways. I mean, just to give you a sense of the kind of thing he did when he first came in. So I told you, the list of values, that one flopped completely, right? So failure. Another thing Dan did, he had an offsite of all of his executive staff. So, you know, within the first couple months of joining, and one of the challenges that we'd had before he showed up was a fair bit of politics, you know, the sort of usual corporate disagreements, backstabbing, unfair practice, all that kind of stuff. And Dan had a sense of that. And at the end of this offsite, it was a 2-day offsite, he said, there's something I need to know about the folks in this room. It was like 12 people in the room. He said, I just want to understand, what's our candor level? He said, scale of 1 to 5. 1 is bad, 5 is good. Go around the room, rank the candor. I won't beat you up about it. I just need to know. So we went around. The average score was like 2. And he didn't beat us up. He just said, okay, well, this is important to me, and I see we have some work to do. So part of the answer to your question, I think, is just focus on it. Care about it. And I do believe people like to ask questions, how do you build a good corporate culture? How do you make it happen? What are the programs you have? And there's lots and lots of answers to that, right? I mean, and we could talk about some of the things that we do. But to me, one of the most important things about culture is any mechanical analogy, anything involving the word build or create or plan or wrong way of thinking about it. It's an organic analogy. Is much clearer. How do you build a healthy marriage? What components do you put into a good relationship with your child? Right? I mean, those aren't. It's not even the right. Anything organic. You plant things. You water them. You nurture them. You care about. All of those are more to the point. How do you treat your employees? Try not lying to them. And actually, it's funny to me how many people in the downturn have been curious. Well, so. Is good culture still matter in a downturn? It's like, how do you afford good culture in a downturn? I don't know, let me check the budget for not lying to employees and see if we've exceeded it yet. I mean, there are things that you can do that cost money. So how do you get a good corporate culture? Let me tell you, the people that do the ranking, so Fortune publishes it, but it's called the Great Place to Work Institute. They actually did a bunch of studies, and they came to the conclusion from talking to employees and what matters, three things matter. And it's none of the things when they come and interview you, and they're always like, so tell me about the corporate volleyball, or what about you have sushi at lunch, right? You know. So the three things they came up with are, number one, do you like the people you work with? They don't have to be your best friends, but if you're spending 8 hours a day or more with these people, it helps if you like them at least. That's number one. Number two, are you proud of your work? And it doesn't have to be, I said it doesn't have to be your most favorite people ever, but proud of your work. You don't have to be like saving starving children, but a good way to judge is if somebody asks you what you do, are you embarrassed to tell them what you do? Or are you like, you tell them, your mother, your kids, your spouse, this is what I do. I feel good about it. So that's number one, like the people you work with. Number two, are you proud of the work you do? And number three was, do you trust management? And what I think was so interesting about trust management, you didn't even have to like them. Do you trust them? Do you trust that they're telling you the truth? Do you trust that when they're trying to get you to do something, it's for the good of the company and not just because that lines their pockets at the expense of the shareholders? So those three things. And my belief is there might be some exceptions to this rule. All of those are pretty, if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of need, you know, from I can't breathe, I'm hungry, I don't have a roof over my house, you know, you're working your way up, whatever, to self-actualization. All of those three things are fairly high up Maslow's scale. So my hunch is, if your employees are hungry and their kids aren't safe, those three things might not be the most important. But assuming, and when you look at Silicon Valley companies, in general, the employees, they're in the zone of need of what size car as opposed to can my children eat. And when you, by the time you've gotten to that zone, I think these things about how do you feel about your work situation, what you're accomplishing, and the team that you're playing for, I think those are much more important things. How do you make those things better? You talk about what it is you're trying to accomplish. So we're in the storage industry. What, you know, we sell giant boxes of disk drives. But something I've actually learned, a lot of our customers are using the storage systems we sell them for really important stuff. I've asked customers, what's the bad thing that happens if our storage fails? And it can be pretty bad stuff. I mean, there's equipment in hospitals and patients could die. You know, it says whether or not they're allergic to penicillin. My favorite one is actually, so I was sharing some of these things and one of the salesmen from Germany wrote and he said, my customer is a brewery and the regulations in German breweries are incredible. If the storage system goes down for more than 10 minutes, they have to stop filling the bottles of beer. His perspective was, what could be worse than that? So you sort of, I mean, if you just sit and go, okay, we built big boxes of storage, it doesn't get there as much. But you sort of push back to a level of what our customers are doing. I think that's an important style of thinking about the kind of work that you do. And if you look for that style of thinking, that can help you find meaning. Different people find meaning in different places. If you're in a place that you can't find it, maybe you should find a different place to be. But I think in a surprising number of places, you go back a couple of steps and then there's people there and you're helping them somehow. And just being on the lookout for that kind of stuff, I think, helps create that feeling for people of the stuff that I do makes a difference. In fact, the hardest of all of them, management trusting is a lot in your control. Don't lie to them. The hardest one, I think, is how do you get, say you guys are going to be friends. You're at the same table working together, now be friends. That one is maybe the most difficult one to influence.
Great. I only have time for one more question. Let's see. We got that table pretty good. We'll get you over there.
So I guess I'm bringing the discussion a little bit back to technology. There's virtualization, and I think there's a huge transformation going on in the data center with several large players fighting for control. And I'm wondering, how do you think about strategy, and if you, specifically about the data center, but also strategy under uncertainty? There are several end games. What do you think is the end game? And how do you prepare for that kind of strategy if, for instance, someone else is in the data center?
Okay, the question is, there's a lot of competition in the data center going on right now, especially with some changes in the marketplace, and how do you plan for that end game? Plan under uncertainty.
And in particular, this was in the context of server virtualization and data centers. Let me answer that question specifically for VMware, server virtualization, and data centers, but I actually think it'll be in a way that will be interesting to the broader question. We recognized a number of years ago that this server virtualization stuff was doing incredible things to the way people thought about their data centers. I mean, people were literally reducing the number of computers they needed by a factor of 10, 20, enormous savings. And we started, and we do storage behind these computers. And so we said, well, what would it need to be, the storage behind these computers? How would it need to be different? What do we need to do to go after this market? And it was interesting because we talked a fair bit about it, and for a long time we were sort of saying to people, oh, you should do something, you know, telling it, and there was a lot of action going on in the company, so it wasn't like nothing was happening, but there was no natural owner for it. And it was, in a way, how would you structure an owner? I mean, it was kind of technology scattered around and field stuff, but eventually, we realized if we want to win here, we really, really should identify one person. And we actually made it a business unit. Success in server virtualization. Actually, originally the goal was a business unit for VMware. And we went and chose a guy who was running the business unit for about $1 billion worth of business and said, would you switch jobs and figure out what it means to go make this whole thing happen? Be the czar of VMware. And his answer was very interesting, and it gets to the heart of your question about multiple paths. He said, no, I won't go do it to be the czar of VMware because I'm not sure whether it's VMware that's going to win. It might be Microsoft with Hyper-V. It might be Xen, which is an open source. It's kind of the Linux version. It may be that VMware does go ahead and win because they've got a pretty good lead. I'll take the job if you let me be czar of all three, and it's my job to balance between them. And man, I'm glad he said that, because he was completely right. VMware's got a good lead, but then again, so did Netscape in the browser wars, right? You wouldn't want to be betting against Microsoft yet. And the answer is, we're investing in all three of them. VMware's getting the largest investment because they have the most customers today. Microsoft, the next largest, because you can't bet against Microsoft. And Xen, the Linux version, a fairly low-level investment, but we're keeping it warm. So, and I gave you a very specific answer, but I suspect for a lot of broad issues, you have to assess probability and probably spread your bet somewhat, and then keep watching and adjusting.
Well, Dave, thank you so much. We have covered a lot of ground tonight. We talked about culture. We talked about hypergrowth. We talked about risk and uncertainty, and this has probably been one of the broadest-based strategy discussions we've had. But, you know, how many people out there have really grown?
I'm one of the broadest.
How many people have grown a company to the levels that you have? So, wanted to thank you.
Copyright Exponential Edge 2009, all rights reserved.